By the time the case came to trial, it was a new era in Europe. For nearly 30 years, Berlin had been two cities divided by a wall. 2 months before the trial, in one spontaneous burst in November 1989, the border dissolved overnight. Thousands of jubilant Germans clambered atop the wall and danced. That night marked the beginning of German reunification, a process that was to be surprisingly swift and peaceful. Democracy was breaking out all over Eastern Europe, and the toppling of the Berlin Wall was the most dramatic event signaling the end of the Cold War. The long-standing restrictions on the export of technology were diminishing quickly. But the prosecution didn't intend to allow world events to influence its case against the three hackers. As Kohlhaas saw it, if the defendants had been working for Stasi, the East German Secret Service, a trial would have been of dubious relevance by now. But these young men were accused of getting their pay from the Soviet KGB, which was still very much in business. The trial would take place at the beginning of January, with a score of witnesses. Saale, a small conservative city just north of Hanover, and one of the dozens of picturesque towns that dot the West German landscape, is the seat of higher regional court for Lower Saxony. All half-timbered houses, bakeries, and pedestrian malls lined with shops selling knickknacks, Saale seems an unlikely judicial terminus. The trial took place inside a courtroom that the Federal Republic spent $8 million to build for trying terrorists. Despite its inviting blonde wood paneling, pea-green carpeting, and comfortable seats, the Saale courtroom is designed to be highly secure. A panel of 5 judges, all middle-aged men, none possessing so much as a rudimentary acquaintance with computers, was appointed to sit in judgment of the 3 young computer hackers. The presiding judge, Leopold Spiller, a soft-spoken man in his middle years, had a tenuous grip at best on the technology that had played such a crucial role in the case. Sitting on the evidence shelf behind the judges, in the space that usually held more traditional weapons, were the spoils of the previous 2 years' house searches. Hess's Atari and Apple II computers, Dobb's battered Rainbow, Carl's miniature Casio containing Sergei's phone number. On the first day of the trial, January 11, 1990, curious spectators and at least a dozen reporters sat among stony-faced officials from the police and the Verfassungsschutz. As the 3 men stood trial for the same crime, they were seated together with their lawyers before the judge's bench. Dobb was the first to give his statement. First, the presiding judge wanted a short lesson in computers. He asked a reluctant Dobb to explain what hacking meant. "As I understand it," the judge ventured, "hacking is an attempt to get into a computer system. How does it work?" During the months Dobb had spent in jail awaiting trial, a legal form of suspended animation in Germany, known as Untersuchungshaft, or pretrial confinement, his mood had plunged so markedly that prison guards began to worry they might have a suicide attempt on their hands. He had let his trim goatee grow to an unkempt mass of beard, and his walk had degenerated to a shuffle. The time in jail, much of it spent in solitary confinement, had only heightened Dobb's natural antipathy for West German authority. From Dobb's slouched bearing in the courtroom, it was evident that he didn't feel up to giving a lesson in computers. "Hacking is the modern art of telephoning," he said. The judge was puzzled. "How does it work?" "Well, you have to have a telephone line in any case," he answered. The judge wouldn't be deterred from his attempt to understand this strange new world. "What if I want to get into the University of Hanover and read a book in the library?" "I was never interested in the contents," Dobb answered, "just in the computer itself." And so it went, each of Dobb's answers more listless than the one before. The other 4 judges grew restless. One played with his watch, another began shuffling papers, a third began to leaf through a copy of Hacker for Moscow, a colorful, breathless account of the espionage story written by a journalist Amman and his colleagues had published shortly after the March arrests. The book was to become a major reference for the confused judges as they struggled to understand some of the computerese that dominated the trial. Dobb's truculence came as a bit of surprise. Despite his low mood, Dobb had offered more cooperation to the prosecutors than either of his fellow defendants at the prison. He had served as a technical consultant and helped the investigators restore the Rainbow computer Pengo had damaged and retrieve the digital SecurePak security program from the hard disk. Okay, said the judge. Let's say we're in a hacker's apartment. What happens now? How long does one of these sessions last? No answer. Despite his apparent indifference, Dobb didn't waste any time before trotting out what was to become known as the World Peace Defense. The group's motive, he said, was to equal the balance between the world powers. Hence the codename Equalizer for the operation. They adopted as their role model Manfred von Arden, a leading German physicist who emigrated to the Soviet Union after the Second World War and worked on nuclear fusion. In his testimony, Dobb perpetrated a popular myth that Arden was an atomic spy who wanted to bring world peace through espionage. With technology transfer, the hackers wanted to do something similar, Dobb explained. Better that the Soviet Union should have more reliable Western software controlling its missiles than Soviet-made software that could inadvertently trigger a nuclear war. What he and his friends were doing was one more step toward world peace. It was an inventive line of reasoning, to be sure, a twist on the codename Equalizer. When his turn came, Peter Carl continued with the world peace defense, but it got a cold reception from the judge. World peace? The judge asked, looking a bit annoyed now. Nowhere in your 193-page testimony to the police did you mention anything about world peace. The judge instructed Carl to describe to the courtroom his trip in the late summer of 1986 to the trade mission in East Berlin, his first conversation with Sergei, and his subsequent role as courier. So you were responsible for marketing? Asked Prosecutor Kohlhaas. Did you ask for someone from the KGB specifically? Asked the judge. No, Carl answered. It was all the same for me. KGB, trade mission, ambassador. It was understood, but not said. If nothing else, the defendant's ostensible concern for the world's military stability proved a successful exercise in manipulating newspaper headlines. Hackers wanted to assure world peace was the headline in the Berlin Tageszeitung the following morning. On the trial's second day, it was Marcus Hess's turn to tell his story. In contrast to Dobb's phlegmatic demeanor and Carl's occasional coarseness, Hess presented himself as a bright, articulate, wholesome young man, whereas each time Carl was asked a question, he leaned toward his lawyer as a shy toddler might retreat from a room full of strangers into his mother's skirt, Hess took command of his own defense. His lawyer was there, it seemed, as a mere formality. What Hess's testimony did, more than anything, was remind everyone that this was an espionage trial. Nobody had been accused of illegal entry into computer systems. No one, that is, was on trial as a hacker. In fact, Hess seemed only too willing to describe his exploits inside the LBL computer. Hagbard had first introduced him to hacking, and in August of 1986, when Hess discovered LBL, which he described as being open like a barn door, he began his most intensive search for military information. It was a bit titillating to go into military computers. Mostly, he liked them because other hackers tended to stay away from them. He explained that he sometimes got passwords by guessing them, sometimes by transferring a file of encrypted passwords out of a computer and comparing it with words in a standard dictionary using a standard decoding technique. Hess rattled off the list of computers he had been in. In his hundreds of attempts, he got into about 30 computers, with full privileges on at least half a dozen of those. And he acknowledged his hacking as something he had been irretrievably drawn to. How is that? The judge asked. Hacking is an addiction, Your Honor, Hess said, and as long as you stay out of trouble, the addiction is difficult to shake. When he did get into trouble in June 1987, Hess testified, he stopped hacking entirely. Hess's principal defense was that his hacking had never had anything to do with the espionage. Yes, he made copies of innocuous software, software that anyone could buy, none of it on the COCOM list of technology forbidden to cross into the East Bloc. And he had given that software to Peter Carl, with the knowledge that a KGB officer was buying it on the other end. But that business arrangement was a separate matter altogether from his hacking adventures. The only material to have gone from him to Carl, to Sergei, Hess insisted, was the harmless public domain software he had copied. In a way, it was a brilliant defense strategy. From the day of his arrest, once confronted with the testimony of others, Hess knew he couldn't deny that he had been involved in espionage. but there was no proof that he had sold any of the fruits of his electronic wanderings to the Soviets. Hess had long since decided that the Laszlo Below letter was a flimsy piece of evidence at best. He didn't express this theory in court, but Hess was convinced that the frizzy-haired Stoll must really be an FBI operative who had worked together with the agency to fabricate the SDINet material, then feed it to Below directly and frame Hess. Even with the Below letter in hand, Hess would argue, he didn't see how the prosecution could establish a strong connection between Below and himself. Even Kohlhaas was impressed by Hess's self-confidence, but he also believed Hess was lying. Kohlhaas had his own careful plan for proving that Hess did transfer information out of LBL and other computers. Cliff Stoll would be the witness to establish that. As far as Kohlhaas was concerned, if Stoll simply repeated the story he had told during his interrogations, especially the part about watching data travel from his computer to Hess's, the case was open and shut. It didn't take much imagination to conclude that Hess was storing the information for a reason.